idea. It's a straightforward catch. You'll see in a playground. A 10-year-old, 11-year-old will catch that, end up with their eyes shut.
There it goes. Dropped it again. Can you believe that?
3, 2, 1. Let's do this. Welcome to Dropped Again, officially episode number 3. Wow. What a couple of weeks it's been. What a couple of days it's been. Before we get into all of that, let me bring in my partner, Shahid Keshwani. Shady, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing good, man. Like, I'm also on the wow phase. Like, we've got a bunch of amazing feedback from all parts of the world, which is really, really cool. So I'm excited to talk a little bit more about that and to kind of get things going into this interview with a big superstar.
Absolutely. I was pleasantly surprised. We want to thank everybody that tuned into episode 1 and 2. We're so thankful for the response that we've gotten. Before we get into all of that, I first of all want to wish everybody Eid Mubarak to those of you that were celebrating. It was just over the weekend. Not the only celebration on the weekend, however. Shady, happy belated birthday, my friend.
Thank you. When I was born, the sun was shining and, I had to make full use of this birthday weekend, which was 4 rounds of golf in, I think, 6 days. So a little bit tired today. We walked a course. Oh my goodness. Never again. I think I got to work up to that a little bit. You can't walk the course when your balls and the guys you're playing with balls are going all over the place. Like, dude, hills and long grass, it just wasn't happening.
Yeah, you have to be a decent enough golfer or somebody who knows relatively where they're going to hit the ball in order to walk a course. Or else, like you said, you're just walking through bushes. Everything is out of bounds at that point, and you're just trying to find a ball, and then you find somebody else's ball and say, "Yep, I found mine."
I think a golf episode is coming in maybe down the line. Just some crazy things. You play golf with some guys, and the things that happen, like Tom Brady. Shout out Tom Brady. You see him tear his pants.
I did.
So, whatever.
Good old Tom. Everybody was going at him, and then he just pulls out an unbelievable, I think it was a 6-iron or 7-iron from the fairway and just plugs it. So, and then made fun of Chuck a little bit too, which killed me. Going on from that, I mean, let's talk a little bit about what we're here for this week. I'm super excited because we finally get our first guest on the show. I think somebody that everybody's going to want to hear from. We recorded this a little while ago, but I mean, what an amazing interview with Ashish Bagai. Former captain of Canada, also just an incredible human being, a Wharton grad, investment banking in the UK. I mean, you can go on and on about this guy. I think he's done it all. But beyond all that, just an amazing person, an amazing individual, a family man. And it was great to just sit down with him and have a chat early in the morning, I must say.
And he loves that gray cardigan of his, man. He always wears this gray cardigan. I usually always chirp him about that. So I'll try to fit that in again. But yeah, man, you should have some interesting stories about the early 2000s. He was just a youngster, right? So, it'll be interesting to see how far he can remember things and what sort of stories that he'll be able to bring out. It should be pretty cool.
Yeah, it was a great interview, one that I'm super excited for. I don't really want to skip a beat, man. Let's just get into it. Let's jump into the Ashish Bagai interview. I'm super excited for this one. Let's jump into it and tell us what you think. This interview is brought to you by The Back Clinic. Use promo code Dropped Again for 10% off. And now we welcome on a very special guest, our first ever guest on the Dropped Again podcast. Born in New Delhi, he would go on to become one of the greatest wicketkeepers in the world and arguably the best batsman to play for Canada. He made his debut at the tender age of 17, represented Canada in 2 Junior World Cups and 3 International Men's World Cups. I am pleased to welcome on Ashish Bagai. Ashish, welcome to Dropped Again.
Thanks, RC and Shady, for having me on. It's a pleasure.
How you doing so far? I know with all this quarantine, you're stuck at home.
Ups and downs. I got 2 little kids, 3 and 5. So there's World War III at home once in a while. But overall, we're managing well. We're fortunate enough to have good health and a roof over our head. So overall, it's been good. But having 2 boys in the home is challenging. It's definitely challenging, but it's fun.
Awesome. And I know we're recording this just a few days after your son's birthday. You just turned 2, is that correct?
No, his birthday is next week and he's 4. So I thought we were friends, but we're really not.
All I get is off your social media, and I think you post once in a blue moon.
Nah, he's so I have a 3-year-old who's turning 4 next week. We're scrambling right now to get toys off different stores for his birthday, but unsuccessfully. So he's going to get like a paper toy that we have to make at home. But the other one's 5. He's about to turn 6.
Okay, there you go. All right, so you've been a father for a number of years now. How does that compare to playing cricket and waking up in the morning to train versus now? Well, I guess you don't have to change diapers anymore, but
very similar actually. You get up at 5:30 in the morning. You put in 2 hours before having your own breakfast, and then the day goes to dedicating to something that you care about. So it's very much like cricket, although I think it's way more satisfying, and it's just a joy to have these two guys around. We can see our own. I had a brother growing up, so we can just see our lives play out over again.
So, boys, sorry, I was a little bit, it's early. Like, you're going to talk to Ash Bagai, you got to wake up early and do the interview. So, it's early, and like, I think the last time I spoke or had to speak with Ash Bagai this early was when he told me that I was dropped again. So, fitting that we're doing the Dropped Again podcast, and I couldn't imagine with the two little boys. Like, I remember World War III. You talk about World War III. That's kind of how it was with you and your brother. I remember playing with you guys in the same team, obviously, for a long time. And it was World War III, literally in the 15-yard circle with you two guys.
Yeah, so we used to fight on the way to the games because he was always late. And then we used to fight on the ground because he used to run me out. And then when we used to go home, we used to lie to my parents about who scored more. So we used to fight on the way there, during the game, and on the way back. And you guys have probably seen that there's some serious fights happening with stumps throwing around, shoes thrown around, but nothing out of the ordinary for.
That's actually funny because now, like, so you guys were lying about who has the highest score, but now, like, the Bagai brothers probably backed themselves a little more in the golf game. So now it's who has the lowest score.
Exactly. That's right. We fought a lot, but over the years, we've come very, very close. And now, you know, best golf partners. We play a lot of golf in the summer when we can. We travel for a once-a-year trip with actually some of the cricket guys, the Toronto cricket guys, generally to Florida once a year. So it's been good. Golf's got us closer, definitely.
Yeah, I've been working on my game so I can join you guys in Florida. So get ready.
Perfect. Looking forward to it. Let's do it.
Now, Ash, obviously cricket is what put you on the map with us and kind of brought us closer together. I want to talk a little bit about your experience coming through the ranks. Tell us a little bit about, A, how you got into cricket. I know you were, although you were born in India, mm-hmm. you were raised in Canada. Tell us a little bit about how you got into cricket and then leading into, I mean, you made your debut at 17 for the national team. You played a little bit for the under 15 team, well, a lot for the under 15 and under 19 teams, a couple of World Cups already, I believe, but then leading into the national team. So tell us a little bit about your journey.
Yeah. So like you said, RC, I was born in New Delhi, played cricket like any other child does in India, in the gullies, in the parks, et cetera. But I was also decent in my school structured program and captain my school team, which was generally regarded as a pretty good school team. But never took it seriously. It was just one of those things you did. Relatively good in most sports. So just enjoyed sport. My mom had a big part playing into that. She used to take us to all the activities, to swimming, et cetera. And then so we moved to Canada when I was about 11 years old. And for the first couple of years, I played soccer quite a bit in Canada. Did reasonably well in the rep leagues. But my brother, Akshay, went to the Toronto Cricket Academy, which is run by Brian Hale. The rest in peace, Brian Hale. Still the greatest coach I've ever had and the reason why I played cricket for so long. And so he used to go there. I never used to go there. He played soccer. And then he, you know, eventually forced me to go there. That was one of the ways we spent time together, was to go out there and hang out. And it was a lot easier for my parents to drop us to one activity versus two. So it was like, hey, you got to go there. And so that was my start. Went there. First couple of, you know, training sessions, just things came a little bit easier. So I really, you know, as kids, you tend to gravitate towards things that you're good at, you get recognition for. So did well, and it was kind of the sense where I was like, oh, I'm getting this a little bit easier than other people, so it's, you know, it's something that I should maybe look into. So over time, I ended up finding a lot of really, really nice people and really good friends that are still my closest friends that I met there. Zubin Sarkari is one of them. Obviously, my brother was there. Andrew Hale, Chris Hale, and the whole what we call the United Gang, because the team that we played for at the time was United. And so that became a second home for me when I was growing up at the age of like 13, 14. And from there, under the guidance of Mr. Hale, got into the under 15 team. And then, you know, the rest was basically on from there. But that's how I got into cricket, especially in Canada.
Awesome. Now, you chose to be a wicketkeeper. I know you like to bowl some leg spin as well. We'll get into that a little bit. You fancy yourself as a leg spinner, although I think your brother might be a little bit better leg spinner than yourself. How did you get into the art of keeping? And obviously, you became one of the best, not just in Canada, but across the globe. I think there was a quote from Adam Gilchrist in one of the World Cups that you said you had the best gloves in the World Cup, which is an awesome feat. So tell us a little bit about how you got into keeping.
I got into keeping when I was in India, actually. So to me, it was always the most exciting position. You're diving around, you're catching, you're always in the game, you're screaming. That's just part of my personality on the field. My off-field personality is a little different, but on the field, I'm very much wanted to be the center of it. So I think the fact that it requires reflexes, it's pretty exciting. It's not boring. I mean, if you think about sitting on the field for even a one-day game, you're sitting out there for 3 hours, and if you're just in the outfield, sometimes it gets a little bit boring. So as a kid, you kind of always want to be in the game and as close as possible to the pitch. So growing up in India, I was always the keeper. I used to like just love getting new keeping gloves and trying those out. And so that's where it started. I came here. Mr. Hale again said, hey, your reflexes are fantastic. You should look into this seriously. And then, you know, the first couple of years I was with him, we really worked on it. But again, he wasn't a keeper. So my education and my training in keeping literally came off Ian Healy and watching him on TV. That was the guy I thought had the smoothest flow, the best feet, the best hands, and the best movement, and just the thought process about keeping that he had at the time. I still think he's the best keeper that there ever was. Not sure, a big fan of his commentary and knowing his hell, and very biased, but that's just Healy. But overall, gloves-wise, I think bar none, the best of
him. He's roughly around your size as well, though, so I'm sure that kind of helped, kind of looking up to somebody.
Yeah, the shorter the better in keeping, but There's
low center of gravity.
Ash, I wanted to know, like, just on that topic, it was one of the things that I actually wanted to know was, like, or is, so who's, like, the I wouldn't say the best bowler, but who's the most fun keeping to? Like, I know for me, as an off spinner, you know, I used to just sort everybody out through the gate and all that, so you didn't have very much work to do. But who was the most fun to keep to? It could be domestic or international. Have you ever thought about that, or is there anyone in particular who you just had a lot of fun with keeping?
Yeah, for sure. And this goes back a little bit down the line, which was around early 2000s. So two people I loved keeping to were Sanjay Thursingham. He used to be a quickie for Canada in the early 2000s. And he started his cricket in India, South India, and was one hell of a bowler. I mean, he had a shortish run up, a really quick gather, and just all arm and shoulder and coming in, and just some rapid pace and at his peak. And the best thing I liked about him was I used to keep up to him because we just had a good understanding and a good pack and a good plan. And although he could bowl really quick, he didn't want to bowl quick all the time because he had plans on different wickets, etc. So he's a very, very thoughtful bowler. And we used to, and at his peak, he was really rapid, but we used to tone that speed down, and I used to come up to the stumps and really work on batsmen together, whether it be through Yorkers, through bouncers, and good length balls. Just enjoyed keeping, trusted his accuracy, and he wasn't really, you know, I used to come up and give him targets to bowl, and he always used to hit those targets. It was just a fantastic relationship that we had. Got a few stumpings down the leg side as well with him keeping up, and just the overall good feeling, and that just took my fear away from getting up to the stump. So that was my first favorite person to keep to. I also enjoyed keeping to John Davison. He was, you know, most of the areas that we played in, a class above his own in terms of bowling. So on pitches that we used to get, which are not test level pitches, you know, some of them were underprepared, not so great in terms of upkeep. So his craft was only brought to light even more because he was able to you know, generally beat most batsmen on those pitches in his time. So again, really good understanding with Devo. He used to play for my club and the country. So basically knew his ins and outs in terms of his run up, what he's about to do, what he's thinking at that time. It's really important for a bowler and a keeper to understand what they're thinking, or for more for a keeper to understand what the bowler is always going to think and what he's going to come back to. So you can be one step ahead if you have that relationship over time. So those two guys were my favorite people to keep. One a quickie, one a spinner.
Awesome. And I think that that kind of leads sort of into the next sort of segment. And it's something that I talked heavily about in the last episode. And it's kind of the theme of what we're looking at when we talk about Canada cricket back then and now. And you talked about Devo and Sanjay. And some of the real interesting things for me as a cricketer is what you just talked about, which were the fact that you guys had a plan and Sanjay was able to slow things down and reading wickets and conditions and stuff like that. And for me, I love that part of the game. And when I started growing up, and again, I talked about it last episode, was how I saw Jeff Thomas do that at a level which was just like how you talked about Devo. I think Jeff Thomas was a cut above and a level above, not only with his cricket, but more so with that stuff, like the planning and just being able to sort guys out. Like 2001 qualifier, Jeff Thomas is the coach and the captain is Joe Harris. We talked about culture. You have Joe Harris, again, this Indian, Bayesian guy. How do you understand this guy? Like, who is this guy? Where is he from? What is he talking about? And then you have Jeff Thomas, this Aussie. What sort of culture and what was the culture like for you from a 17-year-old sort of lens? And how did that impact you going forward? And also, how did that impact that team into qualifying for the 2003 World Cup?
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think back. It's a long time ago. But so I mentioned Brian Hill as the first influence. So these, you know, Jeff Thomas and Joe Harris were the second wave of influence for me. So Brian Hill got me into the sport, taught me the foundation and how life and sports should work. These guys taught me how cricket should be played. So, you know, I was fortunate enough to have both of them as my club mates as well and club mentors and the national team mentors. So for me, that transition into national team was made much easier because I had a captain and the coach who captained the coach, my club team for years. So that relationship was there. That trust was there. That trust between the leadership and the players is so important to know that somebody has your back. And that I was fortunate enough to have that. Not everybody is able to have that seamlessly. So that was good. You know, they play cricket, obviously, I think the right way because I try to mold my cricket around them, and which was train hard and off the field play hard. You know, in terms of preparation, in terms of discipline, in terms of time that you have to put into being around the team, not just your own training, but post-training to sit around and create that culture is something that I don't see as much anymore in today's world, given the perceived lack of time that people have, at least when you're younger. So I think setting that expectation early and having people follow that is really an art and commendable amount of time that they put into the youngsters' development. It was fantastic. So we enjoyed club cricket. We try to take that into international cricket. Obviously, as you can imagine, club cricket's a little bit easier to control because you have a lot of young guys, you see them often, and you're really looking up to the leaders. In international cricket, you get people, grown men who are already set in their ways. So it's harder to control that entire culture. Obviously, I think they did still a pretty good job, but it's much easier to control a club's culture than a national team culture, at least in Canada. I mean, I can't speak for the rest of the world, because I think a lot of the rest of the world gets finished products when they come to the national team. In Canada, you get players that are still developing, still raw around the edges. Even if they're grown up, they're not fully, you know, professional. So it's just harder to mold. Not impossible, just harder. I don't know what I'm ranting about on there, but it's just, I think that, to your point, the culture was set by them, I think, was really important in my personal development. And, you know, just taking a step back culture, and I was just trying to think to myself, how did we get, it just felt different back then. And why was it different? I think part of the reason was we used to get a lot of first-class cricketers from around the world at that time. Who used to play, who played four-day cricket, who played one-day cricket in their respective countries and bringing that professionalism. So if you think of, I'm just going to take you back a little bit to the early 2000s, and you had guys like Ian Billcliffe, you had John Davison, you had Nicholas de Groot, you had Muneet Dhawan, you had Davis Joseph, Sanjay Thurasingham. These are guys have all played, Brian Rajendurai, all played first-class cricket at the minimum at each of their countries. So when they come together, there's a certain level of respect and professionalism that they bring to the fore. Even though they're very different, they've understood the discipline it requires to succeed at sport. So they brought that to that table, and that's why I think that time felt a little bit different and more professional in a lot of ways than we do now. Not to say that Canadian cricketers coming up the ranks aren't professional, it's just they haven't been through the grind of having to make teams, having to sacrifice, and having to mentally stay the course in times of massive competition as those guys did. So that culture was a little bit different. I'm just very fortunate to have experienced that in Canada. I don't think it exists, in my opinion, anymore. So I was just fortunate to experience that culture back then. But it was a great time. Like I said, play hard and work hard.
We'll talk about the play hard on and off the field in a little bit. You mentioned a couple of great things there. You playing with grown men, right? You're coming in at the age of 17 into a team filled with first-class cricketers, grown men that have played cricket not only for Canada but also for their respective countries, you know, and first-class cricket in their respective countries. What was that like coming in? And, you know, we've all played other sports. We played soccer, hockey. There's a little bit of rookie hazing going on. Did they welcome you into the team right away? Was there some rookie hazing? Tell us a little bit about your experience first walking in a team filled with grown men at the age of 17.
Yeah, I think my first trip was to St. Martin.
And, not a bad place to take a first trip.
Was that?
Yeah, I said not a bad place to take a first trip.
Exactly. Like, again, I was fortunate enough to just have a good camaraderie with most people there. And, I think the next youngest, I was 17. The next youngest was, I actually think it was de Groot at 27. So the 10-year difference when I joined as the, and I was just, one, I was decent at my skill. So people were kind of respected that. I think it was, and I was just keeping at that time. Nothing to speak about in my batting at that time, but so keeping people respected that. I think that's the first thing you need to have to be able to fit in anywhere. You need to have a baseline skill that people respect you for. And once that happens, I think I was just happy to be around and travel. And like you guys know, you guys have traveled for tours. I mean, there's nothing more fun than that in the world. So I was just super happy, excited. Like I said, I had fortunate enough to have a lot of my club mates there, John Davison, Joe Harris, and Jeff Thomas. And then people who really took me under the wing, Sanjay, Muneet Dhawan at that time. It was just, they were very, very welcoming to me. And I think also I reminded them of their youth and why they started the game and just brought some excitement. And I still value that in teams, having young people. So I was like their time away from thinking about, how they've aged. And so I was fortunate they used to take me out. When they go for dinners, they used to always call me out. Even when we went to nightclubs, all that stuff, they would make sure that I went along to make sure I have the right experiences growing up, which, again, we think it's super important. So I was really lucky. And, I always have a fond memory of those days with those older guys.
So, for me, like Ash being 17 in the national team, and when I first came on the scene, it kind of gave me that sort of like, I also thought I was not that bad, and saw myself as having certain skills that kind of fit in with that at that level. And I always kind of looked at you playing in the national team and kind of thought like, this is a realistic dream or opportunity for me. So I thought it was always really, really cool. And Ash always had this sort of swagger, even at a young age, with being able to look like he wasn't that young little kid in a grown man's team. So he actually, you know, I always thought like he was a lot older than he was, I guess. So, you know, I definitely commend sort of how you operated and went about your business at that time. And also like were able to perform. I mean, I don't remember batting. Like I didn't even really play cricket at that time, but you were like a little hero for me because you were a young guy playing in a national team. And I was at that time just starting to get interested in cricket. And then like you talked about sort of going out and learning about what, you know, men would do and how they would conduct themselves. And I think it's important because for me, like when I was playing hockey and stuff, that was a norm, right? Like being able to be with your teammates and coaches and go out and all that. But for when I sort of came into the scene, it was in the under 19 sort of camp and those sort of things were looked at the complete opposite. So, and I obviously understand the under 19 and the rules, you're kind of a junior. You playing for the national team also captained the under 19 team. So you were always on tour. So I want to know like kind of what was the difference being on tour as an under 19 captain, sort of leader of these younger guys, and then just kind of being the young kid in the senior team and sort of what was that experience like and what was the difference?
Well, first of all, thanks for all those kind words. I've never heard you say anything like that. So I guess this is very different from you swearing at me and just having jabs. So this is very nice. Nice start to a Saturday morning. In terms of, look, it made, well, one thing I want to touch on, I mentioned all the good things about being young and all the team and this and that. There's also times where people were having a drink and be like, hey, can you get ice? So there's a lot of stuff that you have to also do as a youngster to earn those stripes to get up to that level. And people have to remember that you're young, you come in, you do certain things. That's just how life is. So, but again, I took that as they treat me like a little brother, where I would, at home, my brother did the same thing. So I felt good about that, but there's also that side of growing up with men where you have to do the chasing around, the getting things, the getting water and all that stuff. And so there's always two sides of that story. In terms of under 19s, I always played in teams that were an older age group for me. So I started in the under 19 team when I was 14. And so I was always used to playing with older people, which made it a lot easier to then work with younger people. One, just having the confidence. And the second that, like you said, I mean, thanks for the kind words, but the people just knew that if I'm playing there, then there's a certain level of respect. I was fortunate enough to have that, although I think you should earn it. But this just came with, because I was playing for the senior side, it was just easier to have people be under your wing when you go play junior cricket. So I was confident in my ability. My role in junior team was more on the batting side, leading that front, which was a little bit different. I felt a little bit more responsibility there. And rightly so, we had some really good batsmen on the senior side, so I didn't expect it to go in and just take up spots. But on the junior side, batting at three or four was my role, and that was predominantly what the team needed from me. Obviously, the keeping and the captaincy came, but the runs was what they needed from me. When I went to the senior team, it was more the energy and the keeping and the training standards and all that stuff that the team needed from me. So I had very different roles to play when I was balancing both teams.
You bring up that you obviously were a batsman keeper in the under 19 team, but more of just a keeper in the national squad. You had a little hero moment with the bat, however, in the 2001 ICC trophy. From the stories, and I'll let you speak to this, it sounds like you were in the hospital, what, the night before the game or the day before the game, and then you come out and score an unbelievable knock of 13 not out at number 8 to help win the game. I have the scorecard here. Davis Joseph made 10 not out. You made 13 off 28 off 13 balls, so you're going to run a ball in 2001, which is quite a feat. Yeah, you batted for 28 minutes as well, so half an hour. So you weren't too bad with a bat in the national team. Tell us a little bit about that experience.
Yeah, 2001. I mean, yes. So the story about the being in the hospital is true. I got hit in my throat, and just as a precautionary measure, I spent the night there just to make sure there wasn't any serious damage. And then overnight, we had to play a game the next day, and it was a must-win game. And I was advised by the doctor not to play, because if I got trauma or hit on it again, it could have serious implications. And obviously, I was a little bit naive and young, obviously, and said, you know, well, I'm going to play regardless because it's important. And Jeff Thomas came to me in the hospital, actually, and said, look, it's up to you. And when he said it's up to you, that means you really want me to play, because the doctor has said no already. So I knew he really wanted me to play. I obviously wanted to play. And so we said, well, my parents were also there and they were a little bit worried, but my dad said, look, it's your call. And so we sat together, Jeff, myself, and talked about it. And we basically got a cast made for my neck. And said, look, let's balance this out. And it was like a hard cast, a little bit loose, just so it protected my throat area. And so that's what I wore for the game when I was keeping the next game. So just so obviously nothing happened and everything was fine. This is a precautionary measure that we put around my throat to protect any direct trauma to it.
Is that why now you always wear that gray cardigan?
No, that's because I'm a preppy boy I wear my gray cardigan. I'm not wearing it now. Maybe I should go get it. Should I go get it?
I'm surprised you're not wearing it now, bud.
There we go. That's the shitty I'm used to listening to. Not the you're my hero fucking nonsense that you're putting up.
Listen, it's early stages, you know, like want to make sure that you're comfortable. We hope that you'll be a frequent guest on the show because we're only just kind of touching on the early times here. And I know I cut you off. I know that 13 not out means a lot to you, and it would have meant a lot to me too. Like, fuck it. If I had even a chance to make a 13 not out, and I know a lot of the young guys are too. So, that would have probably taken me right over the top.
First of all, it is an important game, but look, 13 not out is for Canadian standards, I know you're joking around, but any sort of run seems like a good run. But that's the culture. I mean, I'm taking this as a side topic, but one thing if I had to do right in Canada would be to make grounds, pitches, environments better for high scoring. And that doesn't happen in Canada. So people are not used to scoring lots and lots of runs. And that's a function of a lot of things, but I also think the lack of four-day cricket, the grounds, the pitches that don't allow that long inning. So the joke is there about 13 not out, but there's a you know some truth to the fact that it's not big runs when we see in Canada overall if you think about world cricket. So, but going back to that game I still remember vividly because it was one of the most defining moments of Canadian cricket. Us. And a must-win game, running a three to win the game, and on overthrows in the last few balls, and it was Josie, who was not known for his general awareness on the cricket field, was just running around just running crazy, like ran the first one, started running the second one for no reason. Luckily, they overthrew. We crossed again, and then started running again for no reason. Luckily, they had another overthrow. Otherwise, we would have been run out twice in the same ball.
Wow. I think I remember that, actually. I was a kid, and there was so many people there, and they all ran onto the ground. And those are the days of where cricket had such a following. And I think that now that you mention that, I do kind of remember that. And I think that led into the Scotland game, which was like the qualifier sort of game, and I also remember that being at the Toronto Cricket Club, and it was packed. And my only memories before that at the Toronto Cricket Club were the Sahara Cup.
Right
now, just really quickly, I mean, it's international cricket now. Were you around the Sahara Cup time? Like, did you get any sort of help from? I know every Indian guy has a Sachin bat. I mentioned that in the last episode. Even if it's not Sachin's bat, it's Sachin's bat. You know what I mean? So, what was your experience like with them? Like, did you learn anything from them? Did they, you know, did you get to keep to any of their bowlers or anything like that? Any sort of help in there?
No. So, Sahara Cup was around 96, 97, 98. I was definitely around because I was around in the club. So, just as part of the club member, I was around the teams. Luckily, Zubin Sarkar's dad was a liaison for the Indian team. So we used to get some insight and some access to training. And it was more watching them. I mean, I was a keeper, so I was useless to them in terms of bowling. All they wanted was bowlers, as any other Indian team or person needs. It's like, I want bowlers. Nobody else is useful to those guys. So either you throw the ball or you bowl. And I never trained with them. I trained with them, I think, one session, but it's just you're in awe at that time, and you're 13 or so, and you're seeing these guys, Ganguly, Inzamam, Wasim Akram was there, Sachin, Rahul Dravid. You're just in awe and just absorbing. I didn't appreciate I personally, honestly, did not pick up the work ethic or the dedication at that time. I was just in awe of, like, hey, I want to be like that. Not knowing what it really takes to get there. So, if you were back in India and saw them train and grow up, it'd be different. But seeing a finished product at Sara Cup, it was just more awestruck than anything else. And yeah, it was more that I would love to say I trained with them and I picked up all these things, but I wanted to be like that. I didn't know how.
I think I remember, like, so you talk about hard work and sort of dedication to training, and like, I know when you were 17 and cricket at that time, it was just as sort of the Australians or Aussies were kind of coming in with their culture. And I know Davo and Jeff Thomas brought that into play, but did you, like, was fitness, was training, like, I know training back then, when you talk about training, it was cricket, right? Batting and bowling and nets and fielding, and, you know, the fitness side of it wasn't so crazy. Like, it wasn't so developed or encouraged at that time, especially probably in the Sahara Cup within that India and Pakistan team. But
Not the two teams you want to think about fitness in those days.
Yeah, exactly. You don't think about fitness with those guys. But I remember being in the team and the national team at a very early age, and sort of how you went about your business sort of in the early days, and then going forward. And I know we'll have you on again, and we'll definitely talk about South Africa and what that did for you in terms of training. But dude, I remember, like, we were roommates in Sri Lanka. And we talk about waking up early and this and that, like, I must have had a night out and whatever. And it's like, I think it's 7 a.m. And Ash Bagai is on the computer doing this, like, eyes training thing. So, like, he would do, like, forget about fucking working out. Like, I'm fucking in the gym. I thought I'm huge. Like, I'm okay. Like, Captain, I'm ready to go. This guy's, like, doing an eyes-focused training thing on his computer in the morning. And the way that you were scoring runs then and the player that you had obviously become at that time, it was unbelievable to see. And right then I kind of knew that I wasn't doing myself enough justice, and it was probably a reason why you were so successful at that time. But talk about sort of training in the earlier days and would that have made a difference to your cricket or to Canada cricket in general? Or was that just a sign of the times and sort of going with the times?
100%. I was lazy as hell from 17 to about 23, 24. And if I did things differently back then, maybe it would have been a different outcome. But that's just all hindsight, so you can't really do much about it. There was definitely an old time kind of a culture where cricket training is it. And people were generally a little bit more naturally had better diets and, like, didn't let themselves go. So it was enough for that time. Like, you think of the West Indian players at that time, like Joe Harris and all that stuff, they're pretty fit guys, but they didn't do anything, to really get in the gym or like we do now, what the players do now. They were just naturally fit from running on the beach, doing outdoor stuff, eating generally natural foods. So they were overall fit, never did that. I mean, Jeff Thomas brought in a little bit of, like, minimum fitness, so we used to go on hill runs and all that stuff, but nothing like we do today. So I never got the culture boost for fitness from that era. I got how to play hard and how to have a good time and how to build teams and how to build camaraderie and culture. So if I did fitness back then the way I did post 2006, 2007, 2008, you know, things could have been different. But I really think that post that, like you mentioned, South Africa, I won't go into detail today, but that just changed my outlook on life, not just cricketers. It's cricket is a representation of sport. Sport is a microcosm for life. And the way you play sport is generally how you're going to be in life. So, I was able to just absorb that was that the England team was training at that facility that we were in South Africa for 3 months and we were there together. And even between the top players, it was Alistair Cook and Ian Bell in the England team, you can see them being different from the rest. You can just see how every little detail matters. They're just watching their schedules from 5 a.m. till about 9 p.m. when they sleep. It was just like a clock, and you can see why and how people are different. So that experience at the High Performance Center in South Africa changed my life, changed my cricket journey, trajectory, and thinking of what it takes to really change. And we had the best, probably the best coaches, trainers. We had Gary Kirsten, who was our coach there. And so to just give us input and expectations and the feeling of what it takes is just a different level. And we can get into that on a different day, but it's just, unless you do that, people don't appreciate, they just see an output on TV. But if you can, and you know, some people might be fortunate enough to have that natural talent to get through life, but most people have to work their ass off to get to showcase that on the big screen.
You talk about it's funny enough that it took a few years for you to get to that level. Obviously, playing international career for a while. We talked about the ICC trophy. In between those years that it took you to get to that, you played in a World Cup as well in South Africa, yep. Where you there were some highs, there were some low moments as well. Talks about your experience of the World Cup. First of all, starting with the Bangladesh game, the very first game of the World Cup for Canada. Hey, what were your thoughts, your feelings? I mean, I'm sure you guys were all nervous going into that game. And then also, we want to hear a little bit about how you guys celebrated as well.
We had a couple of warm-up games before that Bangladesh game, so we got a little bit of the jitters out. They were probably, you know, we played first-class teams that were at that time probably slightly better than Bangladesh. South African first-class team. So we got a little bit of a welcoming there. And we went there about a month before. We had a couple of tours before. So we were out on the road for a while before the Bangladesh game. And when you're out on the road preparing for a while, as you know, if you manage your body well, you just get better and better and seasoned in the conditions. So we were overall pretty confident. And we also know we had two games. We had Bangladesh and Kenya. And those are our best chances to get a win. And our goal at that time, to be honest, was just to get one win in the World Cup. And then play consistent cricket throughout. And so getting the jitters out in the warm-up games, knowing that they were, Bangladesh at that time, were not a super strong team. They were testing, but they were not having seasoned players like they do now, like Shakib and all that. So we knew we had a chance. And we had played Bangladesh in Canada a few years back late 1990s. And we were very close to winning that game. So overall, the mood was, this is nothing special. We played these guys before, and they're human, and they weren't physically intimidating or anything like that. So we can take them on. So it was all confident. Again, it was our first game, so there's a bit of nerves. We got off to a decent start with the bat, but then came back down to 180, I think, what we made. And then the good thing was we knew that they were also not comfortable in those conditions. Again, that was another thing that if you go to play against Australia or West Indies, pitches are a little bit quicker. There's a bit of bounce. But for them, it was also foreign. So again, overall confident. Batting was mediocre effort. When we saw the ball initially in the first, I remember talking to Joe because he was at Slip. The ball was moving around. There's a fair bit of bounce. And he said, this actually might work because it's under lights too. And the ball was nipping around and carrying through nicely to me. And we said, the only thing that's going to work here is some breakthroughs to some quicks. Josie came on, very encouraging. Sanjay came on. They were both just, I don't know, and just a nice rhythm, which just, once you start off an innings in a good rhythm and things are hitting and your bowlers are hitting, you just get this sense of like wolf pack and just comes together. And we just started building that over time. Luckily, we got a couple of wickets early and built from there. But it was just a fantastic feeling. We worked our asses off and just felt like, you know, life was fair and there's a God. Because we worked, at that time you think if you work hard, you should get something. That's not how life works. But at that time I was young and thinking, wow, we worked hard, we got it. We all know what happened in the second and third games and we got a thrashing. So we came right back down to earth. But I'm glad we had a few days break because we at least got to enjoy the first game's win properly. And that feeling lasted more than a couple of days.
So like we talked about in the first episode, like that game and Austin Codrington taking 5 wickets and everything. Did you guys see Austin Codrington at all after that game, after that night, or did he just disappear? Or did he come back into the camp or what?
Actually, Austin, we didn't see him any night, but that night we did see him because it was about being together. Otherwise we don't see him. You never saw him. He's out and out. Dredd is his own man. But that night we all celebrated in the change room together. Stayed there for a while. And had a few beers, and it was just a great feeling. And I remember we got a message from Jeff Thomas at that time saying congrats. Although Jeff was supposed to be there and supposed to be the head coach, unfortunately for political reasons was not there. But he was in our hearts, the players' hearts that day. And the first thing we said that day was thank you, Jeff Thomas.
Can you just elaborate on that? I know it's a very sensitive subject for you and also for me, because I had a very close relationship with Jeff at that time. It almost, for me, felt like my dad died when whatever happened to Jeff happened. So for the audience, for the fans, like, can you just explain, like, maybe go back a couple of months leading into the World Cup? And obviously, Jeff was the coach in the 2001 qualifier. And I talked in the last episode about the indoor sessions at Kazra Sports and all the training, and because I was, if you remember, I was a bowler, a net bowler for you guys, and was there kind of the whole ride through. Can you elaborate on what you mean by Jeff Thomas and sort of that whole story?
Yes, yeah, so there is 0% doubt in my mind that Jeff was the main reason we were in that World Cup. He came in as a club coach at the cricket club. And then quickly had a reputation that you've built up here as well of the most balanced, mature, thoughtful, hardworking, inspirational cricketers that we've had in the league. And that was seen by everybody, including the selection panel and the board. And, you know, they appointed him as the head coach of the national team. I think one of the best things that ever happened in Canadian cricket. He took us and built a team around with Joe Harris for the 2001 qualifiers, and then trained us, got us prepared for that World Cup right up to the 1 month mark before leaving for the 2003 South Africa trip. You know, we had people on the board at that time that had personal agendas. I was a little bit young to know exactly what was going on, but I have been filled in detail. But post that, it's really sad that for political reasons that, you know, the board had to satisfy and do things along with the, you know, West and East Cricket Board, trying to build a relationship with them at that time in order to, you know, for the Canadian cricket. So I understand the sentiment was in the right place, but I think the way it was executed and handled for somebody who's was the main reason why we were there was a little bit harsh, unfair, and not right. And so just before, I think there was a agreement with the Western Cricket Board that, you know, Gus Logie would have been brought on to take on head coach because they wanted one of their own to get some experience and limelight at that level. And so Jeff Thomas was told right before the World Cup that he would no longer be leading the country. And for someone who had uprooted his family, his wife, and his life to dedicate to a country's development, you know, that was just taken right under his feet. Extremely, extremely sad to a person who dedicated his life to you know, the 14 people that went to the World Cup. So not a right thing to do. Felt really bad. And we had a personal relationship with Jeff. So, you know, no words can express how bad we felt for Jeff. There was a sentiment of players not going because of the fact that, and that was just a, you know, indication of the respect that we had for Jeff Thomas and what he'd done for us. At the end of the day, you know, being the man that he is, he's like, don't do that. You guys go make this happen. Who knows what the board will do if that kind of thing happens. So he just said, go ahead, have fun, play hard, and you know, don't ever forget what you work for. So it was natural that's the first person we thought of then when we won that first game and spoke to and got wishes from, even though he'd, you know, he wasn't there. And he had every reason to be mad, upset, angry, all those feelings, but he was graceful as ever, and he thanked us for everything we've done and congratulated us, and we did the same. It was just a nice moment.
Naturally, there had to be some resentment towards the board but also a guy that probably didn't have much to do with it, the new coach coming in. How did the players take the new coach? Was he welcomed in? I'm sure there was some resentment towards him. And then B, what were some of the differences that were that took place, and what were some of the new the changes that that Gus brought in?
Yeah, look, it was an unfair and not right thing to do for Jeff Thomas, but I also think it was an unfair thing for Gus Logie, and a very hard thing to do coming into a team where, you know, the coach knows that the last coach was loved, left inappropriately, and you have to come in and now rally the troops. So unfair to him as well, and not easy coming right before, because you guys know, you guys have played cricket to a decent level to know that coaching is done 2 years before a tournament. It's not done during the tournament. So it's the buildup that what you've mentally prepped for, get your skills in order, get your mind in order, get your body in order to, and that was all Jeff. And so, you know, Gus Logie had an interesting, a very tough job to come in, try to win over, and then also not, you know, rock the boat a little bit to have upset players, et cetera. So we maintained most of the stuff that we did with Jeff, and there was a strong, you know, captain in our team to make sure we were the team that we had prepared with and for over the last 2 years, not just a new team, because it's very hard to come up with new ways of doing things 1 month before a major tournament, the tournament of our lives. So we maintained most of the stuff. You know, Gus, like I said, unfair to him, tough for him, but also he managed and did minimal stuff. We had a support staff that was at least there for the transition, and some senior players that guided that transition to make sure that we were still a team that we used to be. So he had more of a manager's job than a coach's job. I mean, can't really come and fix techniques, mindsets. You don't know the players well enough to know what they're going to be thinking in situations. So what should I say to the person? So it's more just, hey, things are okay. Practice is running. Okay, good. Again, unfair to both, unfair to the team, but that's just life. Life is not always as you plan.
Yeah, I know that. I know there's a really strong sort of story, and it kind of leads us into a future guest of the podcast. And obviously, he's been mentioned here, and that's John Davison. And obviously, 2003, I think the Bangladesh win was a huge highlight. But I think that 100 that Davo scored in that World Cup put Canada more on the map as a country or a cricket playing country. So I'm looking forward to obviously getting that story out of Davo. Was there a little backstory from that 100? What sort of motivated him? And just from kind of hearing from you, it might even have been doing it for Jeff sort of thing, or just like the win against Bangladesh and just you guys having that extra burst of energy and sort of something to prove for a guy that had obviously mentored you guys and sort of taken you there, as you said. Without Jeff Thomas, Canada doesn't play in the 2003 World Cup. So we're looking forward to that. And I think having you on here just to kind of paint the picture of the times back then is great, because what we're looking to do with this Dropped Again podcast is to really highlight cricket in Canada back then and then also going forward. So we're like, I know for me, I'm looking forward to having you as a guest going forward, and you obviously speak well and are polished, and maybe in the future episodes we can get a couple more dirty stories out of you when it comes to things like chirping and sledging. And so before, you know, we kind of wrap you up, I just, if you can remember back to the 2003 World Cup, was there any sledges that you remember? Anything just absolutely hilarious, like someone sledging you guys or a teammate or you working up the guts to sledge an international player? Do you remember anything, any interesting stories of that?
Lots of stories. I mean, I'm a big fan of sledging in general. I kind of don't wake up on the cricket field until there's some sledging going on. The best sledges used to be Joe Harris sledging our own bowlers in slips. We used to have a club mate that you guys all know, Suki Chima. And Joe used to bowl some fantastic deliveries, but 1 out of 10, and the other 6 were used to be wides. So Joe used to keep sledging. Suki standing in slips right beside me, where he'd be like, "No, what the fuck is this guy doing?" And they're like, "Come on, keep going, Suki," out loud, but like just something completely different under his breath. So those were interesting times. There was an interesting sledge sledging battle between Bala and Ahmad Shahzad in the World Cup in 2011. It's a little bit later on. But that was one thing you guys should check out on YouTube if you get a chance, or the listeners should check out on YouTube. It was it was quite an epic sledging battle in Hindi and Urdu. But I mean, there's nothing specific I remember. I just remember I love sledging, and if there's one story, again, not back in those days, it was a Dinesh Ramdin incident with me in the 2020 in the West Indies, where. Again, this might be available on YouTube, where even the commentator said, I think he's just been sledged out because he got so upset with me just chapping in his ear that he ended up skying one out of frustration and just yelling something and walking away. So that was probably a proud moment for me as a keeper.
Yeah, I think he skied one over to point. I mean, we're going to wrap this up here in a moment. Ash, thank you very much for joining. I just have some quick fire questions for you that we're going to fire away.
Yeah, I like that.
Let me know what you think. Quick answers, right? You don't need to go into too much detail.
Yeah.
Rapid fire.
Rapid fire.
The funniest teammate that you've played with?
Desmond Chumney.
We know Chumney a little bit. Is that because you couldn't understand what he was saying, or just naturally funny?
Just naturally hilarious, a great team man, and I couldn't understand, but I was assuming what he was saying, and that in my mind was funny enough.
Okay, good. One regret that you have throughout your creating career?
Taking fitness a little bit more seriously early on, and taking cricket a little bit more seriously early on.
The moment you knew you made it?
I don't think I made it in cricket, so I don't think I can say that.
Okay, interesting answer. We talked a little bit about your friendships. One cricketer you wish you played more with at the international level?
Zubin Sarkari.
Okay, that's a good segue, I think, to a future episode, so I like that. The best moment that you've had on a cricket field?
The 2003 World Cup win and the 2011 World Cup win, the two World Cup wins.
Okay. Favorite ground to play at?
Wankhede Stadium.
Now, you're from New Delhi, but you chose the Mumbai Stadium.
We played against New Zealand there. We had a pretty big crowd. Just the feeling of that was a little bit nicer. The stadium's a little bit bigger, and you felt like the noise is just echoing all the time. And obviously the ground's beautiful. I got some runs. So I think all that combined is just a good feeling being in that contest with New Zealand.
Best lunch at a cricket ground?
I mean, obviously, the big stadiums have good lunches, but my favorite is we got this fried fish in Barbados at an under-19 tournament, which I still remember being really, really good. So overall, I would say Kensington Oval.
Okay. I thought you were going to say the Toronto Cricket Skating and Curling Club there. I know you're a big fan of the tuna and egg salad sandwiches.
Yes, and the pickles and the mustard that we get are fantastic, but I prefer a good curry and a fried fish.
You stopped playing at the Cricket Club. We're hoping to have you back, but they've added samosas to the lunch now, so that might do you over.
Perfect. Perfect. Hopefully they're bigger than this block that I'm showing you.
The kids are just leaving that around. How many of those have you stepped on over during quarantine?
Oh my God, so many. And it hurts. I scream every time, and then they run around and they do it again. And then they throw the box at me.
Okay, last one. You've stopped playing. What's one piece of advice you would give to the current setup and the current players to get back to the level that we were at when you were playing?
For national club? What?
Which one? National, right? Canada doesn't have ODI status anymore.
I would just say stop posting shit on Instagram and get behind either the net or the gym and work your ass off and let the stories tell the news versus the IGs.
Okay, interesting. Now we are doing a podcast and we want this on Instagram. So the only thing that we want them to post is about this podcast and about this interview, including you.
Yeah, go ahead and post that versus either the past achievements or your half a workout that you do here and there. But go put some serious hours into the background and get to that Instagram when you deserve it.
Ash, maybe you can send the boys that eyes testing or that eyes training thing you were doing. I'm sure there's a little app for that the boys could use.
You're making fun of that. If I had to play sport, I would not play without that. It's training your eye muscles in a way that just gives you that extra time. And, you know, people like Gary Kirsten and all those guys swear by it. We learned about that at the South African High Performance Center. And it's like any other muscle. You got to train it. And you're able to pick up things just a lot clearer and faster if you do that. So you should look into it.
Yeah, no, it's a lot different than picking out the chepras from your eyes in the morning, that's for sure.
All right, well, Ash, I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. Did you enjoy yourself? Will you come on again? Would love to have you again. So I'll leave the last words to you.
Absolutely, man. Thanks for having me. It was a great catch-up, especially in these times in quarantine. You get to catch up with old friends and just have a chat on a Saturday morning with some coffee and some good banter. So I enjoyed it. Would love to come back and wish you guys all the best in these going forward.
And now, a word from our sponsors.
How does your bat feel in your hand, boys? Little crack? Little toe nick? Handle needs repair? Contact Samir at the Bat Clinic, 416-723-8589. Or DM on Instagram at the Bat Clinic. Use our promo code, Dropped Again, for 10% off all services. I just got my new sticks, boys. Can't wait for the season to get going.
All right, well, there you have it. Ashish Bagai. What an interview. That was fun, huh, Shady?
Yeah, man. You got a little picture of a small glimpse of Ash in those early times. And I'm looking forward to having him on again. That was fantastic stuff, man. Like, to hear some of the stuff that he said was also new for me. I've never heard some of those stories about the one about UAE and being hit in the throat and all that sort of stuff. That was not surprising to hear that obviously he would have played, and awesome to hear that he had a nod out and had a huge role to play in that win, man. So what an interview.
No, it was amazing. I loved, he was candid. He was honest. I mean, I know it was early in the morning for him as well with two little boys trying to get birthday presents, but very candid, very honest, very gracious with his time with us too. So I want to talk a little bit about some of the things that he spoke about. The one thing I want to start off with is what really stood out to me was when I asked him the moment where he knew he made it. And the interesting part was he said that he didn't think that he ever made it. And that's interesting coming from somebody who's been respected as one of the best glovemen in the world by some of the best wicketkeepers in the world, but also probably the most successful batsman that Canada has seen. Somebody was regarded as one of the best batsmen in the country from 2007 to 2013. I found that very interesting. What did you think of that?
Yeah. So like, I kind of know Ash obviously. And I think I know what he meant by that. And I know for him, injuries played a huge role in his career. If I remember during my time playing for Canada, like I had a rotator cuff injury, and injuries, like, man, you couldn't get the table, but like the captain's on the table with the physio. So good luck getting a spot on the table. He went through it. And I know that he had a lot of issues with that. He would have liked to have probably fulfilled his first class cricket in Sri Lanka. I know he started playing with a team out there. And I think just overall, he would have liked to have spent more time maybe trying and giving a crack to county cricket or some sort of level of professional cricket. Now, what we didn't talk about in the interview was sort of his scholar's journey. You know, for me, it was always, you know, Ash is brilliant in school as well, and he has all the check boxes, and I didn't really want to fucking hear it, you know what I mean? But no, he went the full way with school and is a Wharton grad, and I think that hindered a lot of his sort of development with cricket, because it was always sort of school and living in Canada and university demands and all that. And I think his parents were up his ass to try to follow in his brother's footsteps, who's a cardiologist, right? Like, I don't know, is that good? I don't know. So that's where he was at. And I think he just wanted to play a bigger or have a better opportunity at doing that, but you got to choose. And I think that he'll live and with those regrets, and that's okay. That's okay. Cause I have some too. I think that's okay in life, but that's what I think he was talking about.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I mean, I think it kind of shows the competitive nature with his brother, which he spoke about earlier in the episode. One brother ends up being a cardiologist. The other one has an MBA from Wharton, was an investment banker in the UK for a couple of years. So that competitive nature obviously showed not only on the cricket field, but outside the cricket field as well.
So how come I'm always like paying for the bill when like you go out with him, you know, he loves to order. And then next thing you know, he's gone. So I'll ask him about that next time.
Yeah, we'll have to ask him a little bit about that. The Houdini, the good old Irish goodbye. Now, coming from somebody that's so successful, he also said that he wished that he was able to get into fitness a little bit earlier. But the one piece of fitness that I found amazing, I want to ask you about this because you're the one that actually brought it up in the interview. This eye test. What the fuck is this eye test?
So like the times where he wasn't on the physio table, right? So he was my roommate in Sri Lanka. This is tour in Sri Lanka, playing Ireland and Sri Lanka A and Afghanistan. And it's, you know, it's there. Like it's just before some sort of qualifier. And so this guy, you know, from when he's not on the table with the physio, then I kind of creep my way in there. And then I come back in the room and he's always doing this eye thing. Like there's like these little balls that move around and he's really focused in on it. Like balls are just juggling all in front of his face. sorry. But no, yeah. So like honestly, it was like eye stuff. And I asked him about it and this and that. And then, you know, like, he's like, you know, you should do it. He's giving me the lecture, like, you know, Shady, you should do this. And like, okay, so man, like, yeah, the captain's telling me he's my clubmate, whatever. Like, dude, at that time, like, I'm not like an excuse maker, man. I was trying to figure out how I was going to pay my Rogers bill. I fucking swear, man, when I was in, like, dude, I had like my Rogers bill back home. Like I had nothing, you know. There was a time where, you know, 6-7 guys were on contracts and they ate up all the cash. You know, it was tough for a guy like me at that time, man. Like I was worried about so many other things. So like to think that this guy is doing the eye stuff, the fitness, like I was a fitness guy, but he went that extra mile, and obviously that's why he was so successful. And I think all the other 6 guys who were on contract for those couple years and were able to put their full time dedication into cricket. And I think that's a huge, huge comment that all listeners need to be aware of, is this was the first time in Canada cricket history that cricketers were able to, guys were able to have cricket as their full time job. So Canada cricket, big shout outs to whoever was running the show at that time to make that happen. I know sponsorships and all that were there, and I'm not complaining. Like, you know, I got my dues, but those 6 or 7 guys in particular, they thrived under that. And I think that's a huge reason for the success of Canada during that 2007, sort of 2011 World Cup. But yeah, that just to the eye test, man, like this fucking guy was like, he was doing everything possible to succeed. He wanted it that bad.
Really shows the work ethic was there. He's mentioned it wasn't there early on, but I think it took him that trip to South Africa to really show what top players were doing, that he was in it, and he was able to bring that into his game. And obviously in 2007, going to the ICC trophy down in, I believe it was in Namibia, scoring 200s, and that work ethic obviously showed. And then he carried that on through to the rest of his playing days. Obviously injuries slowed him down a little bit, but talking about that fitness and talking about that work ethic, his take about what cricketers are doing now versus back then, right? He called them the Instagram models, I believe, doing half workouts and posting it on Instagram rather than actually putting in the work ethic. I mean, I don't even know what to say about that. Like, what's your take?
Well, I've been learning, man. I'm going to start my modeling career any day now.
Well, you take any chance to lift your shirt. I know you guys can't see him right now, but any chance that he has to lift his shirt and show his 12-pack, he does.
12-pack is fine, but I can also deal with a 12-pack of beer. So there's balance there. And I think for me, that kind of chimes into the young guys' comment and the Instagram stuff. Listen, it's a new era, so I get the Instagram. Like, for me, I'm one of those real old school guys, man. I know I joke around a lot, but I really don't know much about the social media stuff. I really don't like it. Although in the morning you wake up, you sit down on the toilet and you're just looking at things and you're like, all right, I guess I need to, you know, like actually I sit on there in the toilet sometimes and then like, dude, your back is just, it gets so tight. But your toes start to get like pins and needles. You've been sitting there the whole time just looking at this nonsense. And next thing you know, you're like, you got to grab the toilet paper, you got to bend. It's not happening. It's fucking chaos. And then you're thinking like, what am I even looking at here? But yeah, you see a few cricketers while you're looking at it and what they're up to and kind of showing their stuff. And I think for Ash and just kind of how I think too, like the sports stuff has to be left kind of in the room, right? Like what goes on in the room stays in the room. I think that side of it for me also is the same. I think that, you as a young guy, like until you're sort of a dominant force, you've won matches, you've sort of established that credibility. And it's not just in the performances, right? It's age too. It's kind of like seniority and stuff like that. And it's just something that has to be respected as something that's been there all along. I think it's definitely different now. Like, so for me coming up as a young guy, it was very similar. It was kind of, older guys, but I wasn't afraid to express myself, and some of the older guys didn't like it or me, and some did and flocked to them. And then all of a sudden they realized, man, this guy is unbelievable on the field and he's a good teammate, and they would understand you over time. Right. So there's always different characters and whoever you are, like I would say, man, express your character. Like if you're on the Instagram, you're doing your thing out there, and you feel like that makes you confident and you're out there and you love that, great. But everybody's entitled to their opinion. So, Ash mentioned like he was a pretty good chirper, pretty good sledger. So you can expect that if, in a game, like you're going to pull tools from everywhere, right? Like now, there's certain things you can't say and lines you can't cross. But I think chirping a guy about his Instagram likes or dislikes or whatever, like it's a heart, for God's sakes. Like they got to make it cooler than a heart, I think. Like maybe like those beer mugs or something, and then I'd be clicking it all day. But that's my thought on it, man. Like I really don't hate on anyone, but for me, my opinion is it's kind of not really hardcore sports, is it?
I'm a little bit younger than both of you, not too much younger, but a little bit younger. So I see where Ash is coming from, but I also see the other side of it, because I think now when you see the top athletes, it's more than just what you do on the court. On the court gets you the respect, but then you have your brand and your personal brand that everybody wants to see and kind of take. And I think that's what people are doing now with the Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, not so much. Facebook is for the old guys. I learned that from a 13-year-old, that Facebook is for old people. So your personal brand is what you're trying to maintain and what you're trying to grow on. And one way to do that is by showcasing who you are as a person outside of the cricketer. And I think that's what some of these guys are doing. I don't have that big of a problem with it. Where I do have a problem when it's just put in the work and put in the effort rather than showing me you're putting in the work and showing the effort, right? And I think that's what some people are doing, is like, oh, look at me, I'm spot bowling for 3 hours. Well, great. How many times did you actually hit the spot? Probably 1%. So like, you know what I mean? So it's like, that's kind of where I come into play, is I'm okay with it to an extent. Put in the work ethic. That's how you're going to build your brand. Because if you're putting in all this work and then you're not performing on the field, well, all that work was for nothing.
Yeah, man. You want to have the respect from the top dogs, right? Like if you Ashish Bagai, like I guess he's one of the top dogs. I don't know, captain of Canada, played in how many World Cups? Like obviously, and he's saying it. So like, you want respect from the top dogs. You gotta obviously deliver and show what you're about, and don't be afraid to express your confidence, but also be able to sort of back that up when it matters. And big games are always a good place to start, but so is kind of training. And I think if you're just like consistent with who you are, right, if you're consistently doing something right, be yourself. You have to have your routine, and I know like we'll talk about more of that routine stuff relative to cricket. And I know that was a huge thing for Ash. Like we didn't talk about his sort of in between ball routine, which became really weird over time. Like I have a weird one too, but his was really weird, where he would, in between every ball, he would take his bat and touch it to the corner of the, what do you call that? The popping crease, or like the fucking corner, man, the one with the corner. So anyway, the corner.
You know what's great is you're on a cricket podcast and you don't know what the name of the creases are.
I have no clue, bud. I'm the guy who's like asked for leg stump and just scruffs up the whole fucking middle thing, like off stump, middle stump, leg stump. I just fucking scuff it all up so I look super cool with my spikes. Like last, was it 2 years ago? I don't know, whatever. My dad bought me these new spikes. Like my dad bought me spikes. I'm fucking 32 years old. It was unreal. Brand new spikes. I remember scuffing up the turf so bad. But yeah, I you know, I don't
that's,
know.
That's the weird thing about Ash too, because if you're ever batting with him or if you're ever playing against him, the way he marks his crease is super weird too, because he does, I think he scratches out an A on when he's doing, because he goes straight, but then he also goes on a diagonal to the corner, like you mentioned. Just, he's got his intricacies, but you know, those cricketers are some of the best cricketers, right? You see Steve Smith, you see all these weird guys.
Yeah, no, 100%. Like, he's doing the A, I'm doing the whole alphabet.
I've never learned how to mark your crease either. So that's it for that topic. I mean, obviously now the young guys are coming up and their Instagram models now. What I love about cricket and any sport really is the camaraderie within the team. And that's why I've always played team sports, right? I love when you're in the locker room, it's just the guy shooting the shit like you and I are right now. Ash spoke about that in being 17 years old and going into the national team. And it was a little bit different than the national team now, because the youngest guy after him was 27 years old, which is a full decade older than him. He's 17. The next young guy is 27. Obviously a completely different feeling. You were coming up at that time too. So what was it like being that young guy in the locker room for you?
First of all, like right off the bat, I realized very quickly that, playing in a national team at that level, with the level that we were at, playing ODIs and first class cricket. Cricket is a men's sport at that level. And in saying that, everything from your personality to how you carry yourself and all that stuff that you sort of get away with at club level on the park bench under that little tree that everyone tries to all huddle under at King City, it's a different ballgame, man. Like, you're, you know, Scotland and these guys are wearing suits and ties, and it, you know, you realize real quickly that it's a man's sort of game. And I think Ash was very mature at a young age. I think it comes a lot from his brother and sort of their competitive spirit, and he was obviously raised, or they were obviously raised like that. He was a smart young man and obviously fit in well with that older demographic. And you know, if you ask me, I felt like if you look at all the good or successful Canadian teams, the 2003 team that won some games, the 2011 World Cup team, they were older teams. They were older guys in the teams. And you can't get away from that. And I don't know why Canada cricket always thought that, well, they've thought so many different things when it comes to selection. But for me, you're young. Like, there's guys in the team now, you know, again, whatever. Like, this is real facts, man. There's some guys in the team now that don't even play in the top domestic level. So, you know, you can't really, it's hard for a guy like me to look like some of the guys, to be honest, I don't really know. And it's kind of weird. Like, it's sad, but hey, those opportunities are there now. Obviously Canada's, you know, in a few divisions below, and, you know, young guys are there and they're doing their thing, but it's definitely a young man's thing. And when Canada lost their status and there was no more contracts and there was no more money and there was no more real incentives to play, and this is a huge reason why we went down levels, is because, well, hey, who do you think's going to be available to play? The guys who need their minimum $2,000 a month to survive. Well, Canada wasn't paying that at that time, and you know, guys, the younger guys or the older guys who were playing, like, some of them had to live at home with their parents and try to do that just to play the game. So those are sacrifices that you'll hear many stories from guests. But those are the things that we're talking about.
Yeah, the point that it always comes back to is, I think being a young guy in the team, right, you always have to have you have to back your skills. If your skills aren't up to the mark, you're not really going to be respected in the team. You're just going to be looked at a guy that just, well, I don't know why you're here sort of scenario. But if you can back it up, which he did obviously with his skill, right, that's where everybody was like, okay, well, this kid is good enough to be here. There's a reason why he's here. Let's make sure that we take care of him. And I think that's what he got out of it. What's interesting is, and this is the thing that hurts me the most about Canadian cricket, is you had some of these great cricketers. You had Ashish Pagai, who lives locally now. I mean, I know he didn't for a long time, but lives locally now in Toronto. You got the likes of John Davison, Ian Billcliffe, Barnett. You had all these wonderful cricketers that represented the country, played at a high level. And you know what? They have no motivation to give back to Canada. And I think that's, you know, and we've talked about this in length before, is that if the system was done right and if the administration had done right by them, they would be more than happy and more than willing to give back It's not about the money at that stage, because it's about the love of the game and love for giving back to a country and a team that gave you so much. But the way that it's structured today, none of them have the motivation to do so, which I find fascinating.
Yeah, like I can't wait to talk to Davo on that topic, because he put a lot into Canada cricket. His family moved here. They were here. Like he was willing to invest a lot into it. And he knows how much Canada cricket gave for him, or the opportunity that was provided for him. He was able to play for Canada and play in the World Cup and set the record and become this huge name within global cricket. You look at him and even Jeff Thomas. Do you know what these guys' jobs are now? So just so you didn't know, like in case you didn't know, and you could correct me if I'm wrong, like Jeff Thomas is like the Queensland cricket, like director of cricket, like just director of like coaching, high performance coaching. You could correct me if I'm wrong. John Davison, oh, he's just the Australia spin bowling coach. Now he runs his own little program, works with Nathan Lyon in and out and all the Australian spinners in and out. And he's one of the most touted sort of Australian spin coaches in Australia. Like, these are guys that we had doing everything for us. Like they were all bought in and all in with us. What happened? How could you let that go? Now, you know, these other guys who played for Canada who weren't from Canada, and they helped us sort of get to these places and do these things. And yeah, they deserve to play in the World Cups and all that. But yeah, at the end of the tour, they're going back to Australia. They're going back to New Zealand. Those are the cricket playing countries. And so that also had an effect on building teams. Now, you know, if that was what they were trying to do at one particular point, okay, like it's going to be okay. But you know, again, there's been so many guys who have played for Canada. There's so many guys coming in, guys coming out. Like this guy played 5-10 years ago, and now he's back. It's just so much juggling, or there was so much juggling. And I know that these guys gave up after, I think it was after 2011 or 2012 or 2013, whatever. And that was the end of that. And I don't think that there's been any sense of professionalism from the players all the way up to the administration. And I don't blame anybody. You know, I blame everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's not one person. I think there's, and I think we're going to need to do an episode just on this alone, is there is a number of parties involved, and it hasn't been one administration. It's been multiple administrations throughout the course of time, is not looking out for the best interest of the cricketers and the country as a whole, which is an issue. And that's something that I think Ash alluded to as well, right? Obviously, some political issues that led to Jeff Thomas being sacked as coach and Gus Logie coming in. Jeff Thomas now, you mentioned it, is the coach development and pathways manager of Queensland cricket. And Queensland has been, you know, for a while now, you can some great players coming through from Queensland cricket, and him being involved in that, that's an asset that we'd lost in this country, and kind of said, all right, well, we don't need you anymore. Thanks for getting us to this level. Have a fun ride. And same thing with Davo, man. And I mean, I know when I started cricket, Davo wasn't around in the local scene for a variety of different reasons. But he's obviously gone on to bigger and better things, and no reason for him to look back or even consider coming back to help out Cricket Canada. Wrapping this up, I mean, this has been a great episode, a lovely episode. The one man that I don't think we can end this episode without talking about is the late, great Mr. Brian Hale. Obviously, he had a big influence on my career and my life. Shady, I know he did for you as well. Just a great, great human, a great coach. It kind of feels weird saying his first name there, because you weren't allowed to say, as a young cricketer growing up, it was Sir, Coach, or Mr. Hale. That's it. I've made that mistake a couple of times, and he did not take well. But really, a heavy emphasis and focus on discipline, growing natural talent, you know, building on what you already have. And just from a batting standpoint, I mean, he was a great batsman himself. Obviously, he played for Canada, played for Guyana, but just an amazing human being, an amazing coach. And obviously, he's sorely missed for anybody that came across him in the cricketing world in Toronto. Shady, any thoughts on Mr. Hale?
Well, I never, as a young cricketer, like you kind of know my story. I came just straight from hockey, and I never really had a cricket academy that I belonged to as a youngster. When I first burst on the scene right away, I knew about Brian Hale. I knew about the TCA program. I knew that it produced cricketers like Ashish Bagai, Zubrin Sakari, and a whole bunch of others. I knew that, you know, he was a very, very disciplined, like you said, coach. But for me, I knew him in a different way because I was close friends with his son. So he sort of respected my game, but never gave me any cricketing advice or tips or anything during my early stages of cricket, because I think he felt like, oh, like this guy didn't come from my academy. And he was so about like TCA and his academy and his brand. And I respected that. And I loved his personality. And he kind of respected me in a different way as being a friend of his son that played cricket. And I played for the cricket club, and he knew that, and he was at every game. So Brian Hill, you know, from my perspective, and this is in two ways. First is as a guy with the ultimate swag, like collars up. So a huge thing was, you know, you got to have your collars up, and his sayings were, you know, collars up and full confidence. And he walked like the walk of the walks and the talks of the talks, Mr. Hill. It was unbelievable to see the charisma that he had and the confidence that he could instill in you. And it really worked for me in my early years at the Toronto Cricket Club and games that were there, because I would always go and say hello to him before the game. So, you know, warm-ups have happened, and I would go and shake his hand. It was always a handshake, like a firm handshake, looking at him, and every single one of his little kids, like there was fucking, it looked like there was ants all over the pitch because there's all these kids like doing this academy stuff before our games. And I thought that was, it was wonderful. And you know, as I became, I guess, a little more popular within the club and one of the bigger players and the bigger team, whatever, they would all come and shake my hands. Like, dude, I got to bowl some off spin today, and you little kids are fucking showing me your firmest handshake. Like, dude, give me a break here. But that's the discipline that he instilled. And I was fascinated by it, man. Like, oh man, I never thought, you know, off the field, I never wanted to be caught slipping, because this guy, you know, he had it all, and everybody wanted to sort of impress him. And I was definitely included in that. So going forward, I asked Mr. Hale in, I think it was 2007, you know, I still couldn't bat. Like, I had little glimpses and whatever, and I just couldn't get the batting right. Like, you know, I was probably one of the top like net batsmen. Just never got out doing this, flicking this, like style out the yin-yang, and really learning my game. And that had a lot to do with my trip to India and stuff like that. So that's for the next episode with 2004 World Cup and stuff. But so I went to his sort of camp in 2007. Like, I was older by then. I think I was 24, 23, whatever. And he said, and I said, you know, I'd like to be able to work with you this winter. You know, I think I need some help on my batting. Yeah, all right, son, you know, come out. And he wasn't impressed by that at all. Like, he wasn't impressed at all. Come out, you know, the kids practice at this time. Come out for nets. So, okay, I finally, you know, get the guts to do that. And I'm going, and whatever, I get there and I look inside, and it's basically like under 15s. Were you there?
I was there.
You were there?
Yeah.
So you'll be able to remember some of the things that I don't, but I sure as hell remember this. So I go in there, and the first thing that I do is put on my shorts and my training shirt and jump into the nets and kind of stand there and not do anything. He walks over to me, says, son, if you don't go and put on your whites, you can go home. So I didn't have whites. So I'm going to my bag and going to the bag area, and I don't remember this kid's name. I don't know if it was Kushru Wardia. I think he was there too. I don't know. Bigger guy. Man, do you have whites? Yeah, sure. You need to borrow some whites. I'm like, yeah. I'm like, okay, cool. So I get the whites on. I go in the net. I'm standing around. So he doesn't even acknowledge me. Okay. He doesn't acknowledge me. Standing around. I'm like, okay, you know, should I warm up? These are kids in there. And I think I'm a guy. I just played in the under 19 World Cup. Took a fiver, man of the match against, is that good? I don't know. And so I'm just waiting. And he comes over to me again. He goes, son, if you think you're bigger than the game, you can go home. Step out of the net. So at this point, I'm panicking big time, man. I'm thinking I might as well just leave because I think he's just trying to kind of prove a point with him. One of the small little kids comes up to me. So he must have told the little kid. Small little kid comes running up because of me. He's like, you have to shake the coach's hand when you come into the net and tuck in your shirt. This little fucking kid told me that. And I'm like, holy smokes, where am I? Go in, shake the hand. I'm like, sir, I didn't, you know, I thought we were cool. I thought we were boys. That was not to be, man. It was totally different. He treated me just like any kid in his academy. And right away, you know, that was a shot to my ego. And it was the best thing for me because the problem with my batting was not my batting. It was obviously the whole mental side of it. And I think that got checked me right away. From there, you know, I got to pad up and, you know, again, another mistake. So padded up, thought I was cool. Had the old two-tone thigh pad. Wearing that on the outside with my box on the outside. Man, you guys can only guess how that went when I fucking walked in that net and this guy looked at me with my thigh pad on the outside. So I didn't get to bat the first day, right? Told me, take my stuff off and you're not batting today. And after he just had a short thing and said, Tiger, I'll see you next time. As if I was not even there. He was more interested in the kids. So long story, I know, you know, that story just had to be told. You know, going forward, it was him working with me on the mental side. He had me, like, I was afraid of pace bowling when I was younger. Some will argue I still am. They'll just neglect how I would hook and pull anyone. So it helped me on the mental side. And the very next year, 2008, check your stats. I opened up the season with 300s. I think two were back-to-back, and I think it was 300s within the first five games. And that first, and all three of them were 50 off 50 balls. And then last 50 off 20, 30 balls, it was big hitting, but it was that attention to detail of hitting down the ground, hitting down the ground, hitting down the ground. And that was something that I always wanted to do. It was preached to me. It was Ashish Bagai. It was Zubin Sakari. It was Jeff Thomas. Learn to hit down the ground, learn to score at a run a ball, learn to defend for singles. Get yourself in, because a guy like you, when you get yourself in, you can definitely dominate cricket. And it was the confidence that I got from him and just those little details and little things that he would say to help my concentration. And, you know, that's the guy Mr. Hale is. And I know we have Zubin on, and there's going to be so many more stories about Mr. Hale because he's obviously a legend in cricket. But, you know, one hell of a guy. The swagger on this fella, like, my God, it was unbelievable. Like, everybody wanted to be him. And I can't say enough about him, and anyone who is a part of the TCA is just so lucky to have had him. I don't know what the TCA is really doing now. It's just hard shoes to fill. Like, he was such a unique character and had such a unique style. I don't really see how anyone could just come in and transition that academy with all the little things that he made sure happened. I can't understand what they would do and what they're doing without him.
I mean, I know TCA is still active. I know they're part of the cricket club now as well, but you spoke about his swagger. You couldn't miss him walking around the ground. He always had a tracksuit on with the TCA emblems on it, his car with the TCA license plate on it, and then he had his walking stick / chair. I don't even know how to describe this thing, but it was a walking stick that had a little handle that would open up into two and be a seat that he would sit on, and you'd just see him walking around the ground, sitting every now and then. But just an incredible human being, 100%. I think anybody that's a part of the TCA family, because we are a family, definitely misses him in the cricketing world, especially in Toronto, and any young cricketer that came across him definitely misses him. So Mr. Hale, may you rest in peace. You're always in our thoughts and prayers. And with that, I think that we should wrap up the episode. So Shady, once again, thank you very much. We had a great episode today, and I look forward to speaking to you all next time. Once again, this has been Dropped Again. I'm Arsalan Kadir. That's Shahid Keshwani. We'll see you very soon. Adios.
Peace.